back in the 1500s, early 1600s, the Solicitor General for England and Wales said something that's stuck through the ages. He said, "A man's house is his castle," or a bit more, "The home to everyone is to him his castle and fortress, as well as for his defense against injury and violence." It's not too far a leap here. We're talking about the American dream and the space we live in on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Home building companies like the luxury builder Toll Brothers promotes large yards, lots of kitchen space for entertaining, a grand view that looks out to a private swimming pool, and in the other room there's even that home theater. The marketing pitch, it helps keep your teens coming to your house. That was a selling point conveyed in this Toll Brothers marketing video.
As the kids were getting older, we wanted to build something that they would always want to come to and bring their friends to. We know that teenagers eventually get in the car and go away, but we want them to come here.
Alexandra Staub is an associate professor in the Penn State Stuckman School of Architecture and Landscape Architecture. She's author of the recent conversation piece, "Is Bigger Really Better?" Alexandra, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So for many, our homes are our public faces. How does architecture shape our identities?
Well, architecture, when you talk about homes that are built by home builders, I don't know if I would really say those are architect-designed homes. It's really an industry that has developed products that are fairly conformist, that are generated to elicit certain demands or certain reactions from the people that see it. So it's more of a marketing issue than an architectural issue. I think that how our communities do shape us is certainly that a lot of the suburban communities that are planned today and have been since the 1960s are based on assumptions that aren't really valid. For example, a lot of those communities are created so that really you need a full-time homemaker, caretaker that is there available to keep up the home, to take care of the children. There's not a lot of things you can do on foot. You need to have a car to get anywhere. And this sort of lifestyle is, of course, not something that everyone has. Most women do work outside of the house, so the assumption that you're going to have a full-time homemaker that's available to manage the home is pretty much a moot point. So in a lot of ways, the housing industry is creating products that are a little bit out of sync with our times.
When you say conformist, in what ways? What are we conforming to?
That's an interesting question. In my research, I've looked at a lot of home builders' products, and a lot of them have website presences, so you can look through all the things that they're offering, floor plans, facades, on their websites. And since the 1980s, we've had a movement away from sort of the ranch-style housing that was popular in the 50s and 60s, and we've gone to more historically inspired housing. So a lot of the homes that you'll see today, at least on the outside, look vaguely like Cape Cods or Georgian or various, often English styles sometimes in the Southwest, more Mexican or Southwestern inspired styles. But a lot of those products are pretty much indistinguishable from another. So it's clear that, you know, home builders are trying to guess what the trends are going to be. It's very much like the fashion industry. They're trying to guess what the trends are going to be, and they're offering products that conform to those trends. And then what you find happening is that from one homemaker to another, the products look very similar. I mean, there might be, you know, tweaks here and there, and the quality might be different, and many homemakers also have different lines, so that you have something that's like a starter home line, and then you have a more luxurious line. But essentially, a lot of the product follows fashions, and a lot of it is very similar from one manufacturer to another.
Well, I think it's a good point to look at this in perspective, because is it driving a wedge into America here? We know we have 1.1 million public housing units across the nation, more than 2 million people, 2.6 or so million people living in public housing. Is this pursuit of bigger, more opulent living driving a wedge between middle class, upper middle class, lower middle class? What is this? Is this dividing America?
Yeah, I think it is in a way. You said at the beginning that a man's home is considered his castle. So this is something that, you know, has been with us through the centuries. But we have allowed housing to really become a commodity. Housing has always represented us, and for the wealthy, it's always been a way of representing their wealth. They've had, you know, opulent furnishings. They've had opulent materials used in the homes, opulent spaces. So that's always been something that the wealthy have used to show off their wealth. But we have a situation now where ever increasing parts of the upper middle and the middle class are being encouraged to do the same thing. And if they can't afford the real stone, then they're, you know, being encouraged to have the vinyl version of the stone on their facade, things like that. But essentially, we've taken housing and turned it from something that we all need, because we all need a roof over our heads to shelter us. We've turned it from basic shelter to a commodity that we're being encouraged to monetize in some way. And I think that's really created a rat race where people are trying to show ever more that, you know, they have a certain level of success based on their housing.
We're talking about a recent piece in The Conversation. It's titled, Is Bigger Really Better? It's written by architect Alexandra Staub of Penn State, an associate professor at Penn State. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Did you buy big? And when you purchased your home, what were your must-haves? Was recreation a focal point for you? What about entertaining? Have you added to your existing home? What brought you to that decision? And builders, what kinds of trends have you seen in the home design and construction industries? Are you building what people want or conforming to other identities? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Alexandra, what does it really mean to, quote unquote, live better in the U.S.? What does that mean?
What housing marketers would have us think in response to that is that living better means that you're purchasing updates, that you have more amenities. So even if you have a house, you're constantly encouraged to update it, to add home improvements. There's a real sort of home improvement craze that's going on in the country as well. So you're being encouraged to use housing as a way to express your identity, as a way of expressing yourself and also expressing your wealth. But the way it's marketed is not that people are being told, oh, express your wealth this way. The way it's marketed is that it's being marketed as a way to bring the family together, as a way to have a pleasant lifestyle. So individual spaces within the house are marketed, for example, a parent's retreat, which used to be called a master bedroom, which now often includes things like a little sitting room and a huge walk-in closet and a huge, huge master bathroom. So it's really a little apartment within the house. Mm. And it's considered an area where the parents can be just for themselves, away from the kids. So these sorts of things, we didn't have that in the 1950s or 60s. These are sort of new products, if you will, that have been introduced into the housing market. There's a question of, do we really need this? I mean, you asked before, you know, are builders building what people really want? But if there are so few alternatives, and, you know, it's not because architects are not creative enough to come up with interesting stuff. I've taught housing studios in my teaching at Penn State, and you'd be surprised at the wonderful creative ways that young people can consider housing, and of course many architects can as well. But there's a whole marketing mechanism where it's very, very hard to actually produce these sorts of things and to get this out into the public, because there's so much marketing effort put into the traditional suburban lot with the house on it, which of course you can monetize much easier.
We're looking at the ethical dilemma we have in our big houses. Is this upward mobility? Is this pursuit for more space akin to keeping up with the Joneses? Or has this Joneses thing got out of control? You're with us on The Morning Show. Architect Alexandra Staub is here. She's an associate professor in the Penn State Stuckman School of Architecture and Landscape Architecture. Her recent piece in The Conversation is called "Is Bigger Really Better?" Join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we need a large home and the products needed to run them? Or would we be better off downsizing? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings, back after this news update. A new strategy has hit luxury real estate markets like LA and New York. Apparently, it's called white boxing, where you strip everything down to the studs, rip everything out, even luxury kitchens and baths, and you start over. This trend is actually making properties more valuable because buyers don't feel remorseful about doing the environmentally unkind thing of ripping everything out themselves. It factors into this conversation about is bigger really better that we're having here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at the ramifications of the middle class pursuing bigger footprints, more luxury living. Architect Alexandra Staub has been writing about this in The Conversation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you struggle to afford housing? How do bigger homes make you feel about the housing industry? What do you think is the future of big space living? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Marcelo in West Lima. Hi, Marcelo.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Go ahead.
I've been advocating for eco-village makers districts run as workers' cooperative corporations, essentially a more communal-type living built out of natural materials, possibly compressed block. And I was wondering if your guest could comment on that as a way to return to a more community-focused, people-focused, rather than economic-focused shelter. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcelo. Alexandra, what about eco-villages? And also, I know you lived in Germany on sabbatical, perhaps bringing in more of a worldview here.
Yes. Well, there's. Thanks very much for your question. I think there's a few issues here. So ethically speaking, these huge houses have a lot of problems. One, of course, is the carbon footprint that they represent. Another one is, as I alluded to before, the fact that you have to have a lot of upkeep on these huge properties, and that upkeep is usually, in today's world, been outsourced to companies that send in workers working at minimum wage with no benefits. And the third thing is also then that as we privatize more and more of these amenities, so, for example, as people have in-ground pools and these huge gardens, then we no longer have an incentive to have more community arrangements such as municipal pools or nice parks with a lot of amenities. So things like eco-villages would address these problems in a number of ways. One is we're certainly capable of trying to lower our carbon footprint by building more intelligently, being careful in terms of the supply chain where we're sourcing our materials, looking at what kinds of materials we're using. So these eco-villages, if they're doing that correctly, do that. And also trying to use renewable energy in heating and cooling our homes, things like that. And these are things that we can do. Technologically speaking and technically speaking, we certainly have the capability of doing this. It's just that we need to have the political will to do this. And the other thing is that if we can create community that does not involve having a huge house where we're basically inviting the community into our private, castle, inviting all the kids over to swim in our private pool, for example, if we are redefining ideas of community to include a greater community, I think that's a really positive step. And we constantly talk today about the fact that the U.S. has become so segregated, not just racially, but also politically. And we don't have as many spaces as we used to where people can just serendipitously come together and meet other people, these so-called bump rooms where you just happen to bump into people and you can strike up a conversation. We have less of those, I think, than we used to, and that is also a detriment to our communal life, if you will.
Marcelo, thanks for the call. And Alexandra, you did, though, live in Germany. What did you learn about the way people live there, and how does that compare to how we live here in the U.S.?
Well, I lived in Berlin, Germany, which, of course, is the capital city, for a year last year. And I also have to say I lived about 20 years in Berlin after I actually got my architecture degree there. So I'm very familiar with the city and have seen how it's developed over time. One thing that really struck me in my life there last year, though, and I was living there with two children. We lived in a very small apartment, and it wasn't a problem living in a small apartment. We, of course, have a much larger space in the U.S., but there's so much to do in the city that is so accessible. Even for the children, it was accessible. My 16-year-old was able to go out. She didn't, drive, but she was able to use public transportation to get to all sorts of events. The events were either free or low cost in most cases, so they attracted a wide variety of people. There are often spontaneous events that happen in parks. People will come together. There will be, just entertaining events, activities that happen that pretty much anyone can join into. And this level of spontaneity and this level of accessibility was just really, really refreshing for the whole family. So that was something that I really find missing in the U.S. You have very few cities, I think, where you have that kind of spontaneity and that kind of accessibility on a regular basis.
Let's go to Dave now, joining us from Delavan. Hi, Dave.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. I want to thank the guests for the wonderful things that you're expressing here. I agree completely, and I'm also gratified to hear it as a Penn State alum myself. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your work. We purchased our house back in the early 90s, and we had been pre-approved by the bank for an amount that we thought was just incredible, and we decided rather than being house poor, we would buy something smaller and simpler than what the bank seemed to think we should be buying. And we've never been sorry. We had money to travel with our kids. We had money to pursue other interests. It just seemed foolish to us to spend our entire lives working for nothing but maintaining a house.
Dave, thank you so much. Alexandra, what do you make of that? Because Dave chose not to be house poor. We hear that a lot today, especially mm-hmm. in larger cities where cost of living is extremely high.
Right. I think that's great. And he's pointed out two things. One is traveling. So essentially, if you have a roof over your head that's providing your, basic necessities and providing a space for your family, in order to get entertainment, which recreation, you need to travel outside of those walls then. And through traveling, through going to events in the city, if they're available, that's one way of doing that. So I think you gain in that way because it also takes you out into a broader community. I think that's one of the real issues that we're looking at here, that you're stretching your experiences by getting new experiences.
Dave, thanks. Alexandra, this home improvement craze that you've been talking about, Is that fairly recent, or has that been happening all along? Or perhaps is that because we're now in a time when older homes, 50, 100 years old, are actually needing improvements?
Well, there's two things here. One is maintenance, and the other one's improvements.
Uh-huh.
So older homes, of course, do need maintenance. And, you know, as an example, in the home that I live in, which is from 1940, we just put in a new bathroom because pretty much everything in that bathroom was cracked or falling apart. But there's a difference between maintaining something, and you do have to regularly replace appliances and, you know, do work on walls and things like that. But what we're talking about is really significant home improvements. And I don't have statistics on this, so I can't give you, you know, a hard figure, but my gut feeling is that the trend has certainly been towards encouraging people to spend money on new things, on home improvements, putting in a new fireplace, putting in new decorative accents, putting in new kitchens, even in a fully functional kitchen, tearing everything out because the fashion is now stainless steel and granite countertops, for example. And that's certainly been a trend. There's also a lot of home improvement shows that have come up on cable TV. And I did read an article on this recently where there's been a dramatic increase in those over the 80s and 90s. I think the 90s it really started taking off. Where you have many, many more hours of these home improvement shows, starting with This Old House, which was, I think, a PBS show,
yes.
Right? And but going now to a lot of cable TV, this Extreme Makeover trend, for example, these sorts of shows, which basically go from, you know, taking a small house and turning it into something really luxurious. So, you know, there's certainly a market for that, and I think that sparks people's imaginations in terms of, oh, I could do this too. And then there's a trend towards, if you do it yourself, you can keep the costs down. And, you know, the question is, do we really need this, or are we, I mean, for some people, they might find it pleasurable to, you know, get into tinkering and doing home, building something. I think that's a wonderful thing. But for a lot of people, I think it can really end up in being quite frustrating if the results are not what they expect, or if it ends up, you know, not being as they want, or if it ends up just requiring a lot more maintenance long term because they've suddenly pumped up their home to a point where they're just constantly having to invest in it.
We're talking with architect Alexandra Staub of Penn State's Stuckman School of Architecture and Landscape Architecture, looking at the pursuit of the American dream, social implications of what happens when the middle class seeks opulence in housing. 800-642-1234, gathering your insights. How did you decide to buy? And when you purchased your home, what were your must-haves? Have you added to your existing home? What kind of space did you add and why? And builders, what kind of trends have you seen in home design and construction industries? Are you building what people want, or is the bigger is better trend in housing good for business? What changes have you seen in housing trends over time? 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Vern now, who's waiting in Stanley. Hi, Vern.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah. See, we have what's called a uniform dwelling code in Wisconsin. So about 1980, that came into effect. So people just couldn't build a house with all these permits. And they made so many rules and restrictions that you can't build an affordable house. You know, people should be building 1,200 to 1,600 square foot houses, but they have made the rules so complex and so difficult. We actually have a housing crisis up here because a lot of the buildings are very, very old. They do remodel them, but they can't extend and do a lot of stuff because they're grandfathered in under certain stuff.
So are you saying building codes are really stringent, or that building codes need to be updated?
They're stringent.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're doing, that allows, like in Eau Claire, the wealthy get to live in their section, exclude the poor, and they basically govern out in the townships and tell us what to do. We have no saying in how we build a house or can build a house. Like now, up to 1980, you could just build a house and be done with it.
Mm.
You could afford to do it. Now you cannot. So we have a lot of people that are homeless that they just don't know about.
Vern, thank you so much for the call. Alexandra, how do housing codes factor into this?
Well, housing codes are more regional. So that's, from being from Pennsylvania, that's something that I can certainly empathize with that situation. But let me maybe bring in the German example again. In Germany, with new construction now, the codes are very stringent. As a matter of fact, all of the things that we're able to do in order to keep our carbon footprint down, insulating the house as well, using renewable energy sources, things like that, that's written into code in Germany. But people are also able to get subsidies in order to build in that manner. So I would say that the types of codes maybe that are being required in the area that Vern is talking about, ideally what we should be looking at is writing codes so that houses are constructed more energy efficiently, because that is really something that we've got to look at for the future. Houses are things that stand for decades, so we can't just, build them for the next 5 years. It really needs to be something where we have an eye towards the future. And I think our energy situation, although it seems fairly rosy, we're fracking, we're, getting cheap energy in, but in terms of long-term thinking, I think that's one direction that we need to move into.
Isn't it California that just made a law saying that new homes, all new builds, have to have
solar panels?
Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely. But I was on vacation in Florida once, and I did not see a single solar panel in my travels through that state. And they have, it's called the Sunshine State, isn't it? I mean, this is something that kills me. There's no political will. We have the current administration, the national administration, that's just put an import tariff on solar panels, which makes it more expensive to import and use them. And that might spur the domestic industry of solar panels. But still, this is something, this is low-hanging fruit, because it's been around for decades, and other countries are using this technology and are successfully using it. And we are not. So, there's a lot more that we could do in terms of scale.
I was struck by, in your article, the Toll Brothers promotional videos that were embedded in the article. Watching them and seeing these testimonials of how these families wanted to create memories in their own home where that they said their kids would always be there, always coming back. It's as if they wanted to make sure that try to keep things the same, the whatever was going on in psychologically was really fascinating there.
It is, yes. It's a big selling point. This idea, there's two things actually that are used as selling points as I've analyzed it. One is this idea that with the right home, your family will be happy. And this started actually, in the 1920s when the servant crisis hit and people no longer had servants, and then women were encouraged to have the right cleaners or the right personal products in order to keep the family happy. And then in the 1950s, it expanded into ever more products, and now it's the whole house that's seen as a product. So if you buy the right house, your family will be happy, and the house will also be easy to clean, which of course, it's not. Big space just requires more time to clean and to maintain. So this, this sort of psychological message that your family will benefit and family happiness will benefit is a big one. And at the same time, though, we're also shown these master bedroom suites where the parents are shown that they need a retreat. So I sort of wonder, which one is it? Is it that you're trying to get away from your kids and you need the master bedroom retreat? Or do you want to be with them constantly, which is why you need the huge kitchen and family room?
We're talking with architect Alexandra Staub of Penn State's Stuckman School of Architecture and Landscape Architecture, getting your insights as well. 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this conversation after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the impact of upward mobility in the U.S., what it means when the middle class seeks bigger homes, more amenities. Consider this, 65% of communities built in the 1960s or earlier had public transportation. by 2005 with an increase in multi-car families. This was only about 32%. We're looking at the implications here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The luxury home builder Toll Brothers produces testimonial videos. This one, the woman talks about her, quote, vast home and the ability to host her kids' baseball team for pizza in the big kitchen with a seat for everyone.
We just really want to cherish this time because in not too very long, the baseball shoes will not be on the floor to trip over. So we really just want to hang on to the time that we can. This is the house that is going to have built those memories.
In the first quarter of this year, Toll Brothers' average price point on a new home was $826,000. Alexandra Staub stays with us. She's an associate professor in the Penn State Stuckman School of Architecture and Landscape Architecture. Your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Cleaning companies, we want to hear from you. Have you seen work for people who help maintain bigger houses? Has that increased? What does this mean for your staff? On the other hand, have you downsized in recent years? Why did you do so? What did you give up? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Tom in Mequon. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. Alexandra, my father was an architect and a builder. He was in love with Frank Lloyd Wright's work. We live in Wisconsin now, and I guess that's really being driven home to me. I noticed that the builders, they don't seem to be concerned about integrating the inside, the interior and the exterior of the house, the land. And my wife and I just, we used a software product called Revit, a three-dimensional design product. We were able to figure out how to integrate especially the rear of the house with the landscape. We built a about $10,000 or $15,000 extra egress from the basement area to the outside, and it just integrated everything: the upstairs, the downstairs, the inside, and the outside.
Tom, thanks so much for the question. Alexandra, what about programs that help integrate the landscape around you?
Well, you mentioned Revit, which is actually not that easy to use, so congratulations. Something our students usually take about a year to master, and those are architecture students. I think that one thing that is great is when individual home builders do make more efforts to integrate the building with the site. Many developers, they go into a site in Pennsylvania, and I imagine it's the same in Wisconsin. Oftentimes what happens is an old farm gets bought up. The area is pretty much raised, and bulldozers come in, take out all the trees, everything. New streets are put down, new infrastructure in terms of water lines, sewage, things like that, and then the houses are designed and then new trees are planted. So that's the typical sort of cycle. So there's no real landscape to speak of. The landscape is put in again after the houses are built. And I think it's wonderful when the existing landscape is used and existing trees, for example, are used in considering how to site the home. That's something that takes time, and it's something that takes effort, and time being money, of course, that's an area where a lot of developers will try to cut costs. I'd also like to mention one thing, though, and that's, the need for alternatives, because a lot of the people that we've spoken with, it seems that they've bought single-family houses on lots for a family. But what if you're not that? What if, for example, you're a young couple that doesn't plan to have a family, or what if you're a gay couple, or what if you're just a single person? So does that mean that you are going to be forced into this sort of suburban living, or how many alternatives do we have? Do we have pleasant places for people to live that are not considered, starter apartments? That would be a question as well. I know that doesn't speak so much to Bob's comment, but I think that's something I'd like to throw in as well.
Let's go to Verge now in Door County. Hi there.
Hi. I'm an architect who uses Revit, by the way, and you're right. It takes about a year to learn to master it.
Yes.
But I'm also a general contractor. And I became a general contractor because I really wanted to understand why the cost of construction was going up so high. I've been an advocate of small homes my entire career of 30 years. And I did this because I did my master's thesis on family housing from 1939 through 63. And what we've seen here in the United States is an expansion of houses from approximately 680 square feet for a family of four up to 2,700 square feet for a family of three. We have, outside of Canada, we have the largest houses per person in the world. And yet, we're not finding the family satisfaction that we used to. And Alexander, you're making so many wonderful points, and all the rest of the callers are making wonderful points, too. So what we need to do is use the same marketing techniques that they used back in the 40s and 50s to introduce people to cleaner living and, you know, more satisfactory lifestyles, and use that towards the rationale that smaller homes give you more money, more disposable income to really enjoy life, to have vacations with your family instead of just paying the mortgage every month.
But Virg, how do you advise your clients then when they might be swayed by other thinking, that they want other amenities, and as they add these amenities, you see them scaling up, adding on?
What I advise my clients is this. I advise them that, for instance, I've worked with a number of people who have very large homes, you know, 4,800 square foot homes, and they feel like they cannot possibly live under, say, anything less than 3,500 square feet. I tell them to rent a condo for a year that is about, you know, 2,400 square feet. See how that feels. And without exception, every single person that has gone through this exercise has come back and said, wow, I didn't realize how much living we can pack into 2,400 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so people just need to become conscious of what space means. And I realize, you know, with HGTV and everything else, people are enticed into this belief that they have to have all this stuff, you know, and all this space. But when you really live a life and realize how much life you can have outside of your home, you know, better meals in restaurants, more vacations, more, you know,
the trade-offs,
more memories.
Let's get Alexandra here. And we're just saying, conscious of what space means. Go ahead, Alexandra.
Well, I think you're making excellent, excellent points. And, you know, as I said before, I was in Berlin last year on sabbatical. I lived in three of us were living in an apartment that's about, 63 square meters, which is like 700 square feet. So, you know, it worked. But it worked because we had a large courtyard that was shared right outside our door with a large lawn and places to sit. And we had public transportation right outside the door that took us to all parts of the city where we could do anything we wanted to. We had cafes, we had restaurants, we had concerts, we had parks, we had just a lot of stuff available to us. So those amenities that we like to take part of weren't private amenities for us. They were shared amenities shared by the whole city, and we had access to them, and it was pretty easy to get access to them. And I think that's one thing that we're missing in the U.S. We don't have enough public amenities anymore because in a lot of places, people are just, you know, not willing to pay for that, unfortunately. And I think that's what's really missing. But the other point you're making, too, which is, you know, vacations and taking the money that otherwise you'd be spending on upscale housing and putting that into something else, that's a great way of making those family memories. You don't have to have your pool and your huge, you know, family room where you can have the whole baseball team over for pizza every week. That's not the only way of making a family memory. And I really think what we're missing in today's world is alternatives. So I think it's really great that you're talking with your clients about these things and trying to get them to think in terms of alternatives, because the main message that we're hearing is we really need to be buying all of these spatial amenities for ourselves, for our own private use. And that's not the only way to go.
So where do we go from here? What do you see as the next step? What are you hoping for?
What I'm hoping for, and, you know, I work with young people because we educate architects. We have two professional programs, a bachelor's program and a master's program. So we do a lot of projects, and I see so much creativity in these kids. You know, I see so much brimming creativity. And then when they get out, you know, you have a lot of younger architects that are full of ideas of, you know, how you could do stuff better, how you could arrange space better, how you could create things. I think one thing that we need to look at is to really put more effort into creating alternatives and put more of it's a financial question too, because building anything, of course, is very expensive. But if we have more people on board that would be willing to experiment with, for example, building communities that are based on having smaller individual spaces and more communal type spaces, if we're willing to invest more in urban facilities and city facilities that are open to a majority of people, that are affordable enough. So, you know, not having the private gym so much as a public park that's available to everyone. I think those are the sorts of things where we need to push. And this is a political question again, you know, because it's really a question of where we want to put our money as a society.
Well, Alexandra, thank you so much for your time.
Yes, well, thank you very much. I see we're at the top of the hour again, so it's been a pleasure to be with you.
That was Alexandra Staub. She is an associate professor in the Penn State Stuckman School of Architecture and Landscape Architecture, author of the recent conversation piece, Is Bigger Really Better? This hour of the morning show was produced by Chris Molina, Keely Boltina, Brianne Chasso, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.